Beyond Us and Them, podcast on radicalization in the times of social polarization. Welcome in the podcast of Resilience Through Education for Democratic Citizenship Project. My name is Filip Pazderski, and we continue the discussion on how social polarization and radicalization threaten our democracies. Today we will look at how online communication and particularly social media can be used to foster radicalization and to disseminate extremist views. We will also try to discuss what can be done to counteract this phenomena. In this regard, we are proud to host today Natalie Patton. Hello.
Hello, and thank you for having me.
Thank you for being with us as well. Ms. Patton is a research fellow at École des Hautes Études en Sciences Sociales, what stands for the School of Advanced Studies in the Social Sciences in Paris, where in addition to her other commitments, she was she is involved in implementation of EU Horizon 2020 project entitled Dialogue About Radicalization on Equality. In particular, she was responsible for a research on drivers of self-radicalization and digital sociability in France and Europe, what makes her such a great interlocutor for us today. Okay, so thank you once again for being with us. And maybe, okay, and maybe to start with, we can try to set a scene a bit and discuss a bit on the situation of radicalization and extremism, maybe in France, since you are located and located in France as well. But maybe also you can tell us a bit if the situation in France, how it manifests itself, differs somehow to how it looks in Europe, or maybe no.
So you mentioned the project I was a part of that's still an ongoing project. It's a project that will be ending in 2021. It's a four-year project. And in that project, we did tackle several countries. The part I was in charge of deals with online radicalization and extremism. It dealt with far-right extremism just as much as Islamist extremism. So it took a very interesting perspective on radicalization, since it dealt with two different forms of extremism. As for the European situation and the French situation, you're not talking to me about the United States situation or the Brazilian one, and there's so many other countries we could tackle. But if we limit it to Europe, the situation from internet perspectives exclusively, and I'm only going to speak on that from that perspective, has evolved over the last few years pretty dramatically. When we started this project in the drafting, before we actually even deposited, it was back in 2015, 2016. In 2015, 2016, ISIS was still alive and kicking and actually very strong and growing, and had a very strong online presence, in particular on mainstream platforms such as Twitter, Facebook, YouTube, etc., which is not true anymore, which is not true at all. They have gone back to more underground channels and even more the things that are out of reach of mainstream content. As for the far right wing, things have changed dramatically since 2015. Dramatically in the sense, as I cited, two countries which weren't random, of course, the United States and Brazil have known right-wing leaders as their presidents, as legitimate discourses. And the situation online has kind of fallen in the tracks. One of the elements that we may discuss further now, I'll finish on this before talking about France, is one of the elements that was very apparent to us was that the right-wing extremists online is loud and proud and growing in numbers. Whereas Islamist extremism, it's the exact opposite. I mean, we're in another situation. As for the French situation, France unfortunately has a kind of a sad history of being striked the most by Islamist extremist jihadist type attacks in the recent years. I think we have unfortunately the highest count of attacks in the last few years, but even before that. And as for the far right wing, we're pretty well situated too. And if I'm saying that ironically, of course, but the far right wing is strong with Marine Le Pen that has been elected, has been part of the second round of the way the presidential elections work in France is there's two rounds and there's two candidates standing at the end, and she has been part of the last two rounds. And she's foreseen as the upcoming runner and probably going to be about part of the second round. So France is well known as in Europe as a place where radicalization is present. We had a very high count of people going to countries such as Syria and Afghanistan when ISIS was still strong. We were amongst the top countries in Europe with Belgium or other countries nearby. So France is particular in that respect.
And since you already mentioned this, that your area of study is actually how these phenomena manifest themselves online. And apart the fact that you are working on that, I also wanted to ask you why you believe it is important to observe what's going on online, in social media, and so on.
I believe strongly there's a lot of reasons why which it's important to. The first thing that kind of, and this is particular to the branch of research I do, which is online studies of political expression and political violence in particular. There's this common sense understanding that what goes online just goes on online, as if there was a disconnect between offline and online, and as if we didn't spend I don't know how many hours a day on our phones every day or on the internet every day. Studying what's going on online is essential because not only does it directly impact our behavior offline, but also because there's particular trends online that can only be researched or seen in that realm, in that space. And online activity changes a lot of elements of how societies go about their business nowadays. It has an impact on the democratic balances of society. It has an impact on sociability, meaning how groups come together. It has an impact on autonomy of individuals. Just those three aspects of political balance and of groups of individuals is extremely important to take into account if you want to properly understand radicalization and extremism nowadays.
And could you maybe elaborate a bit more on each of these points?
Yeah, the first thing what I'm mentioning is the political impact it has on democratic balances. What internet has massively changed in a way that people don't necessarily see is that it allows people to have a voice where they don't necessarily have a voice in. It doesn't mean what you say online is seen. There's a big difference between publishing online and actually your content being seen, but you do have access to what we call the public space or the public sphere, theoretically in social sciences. In offline, to have access to that, you have to go typically through newspapers. And there's gatekeepers, I mean, to the TV, there's gatekeepers who kind of censor and have a role of censorship. This doesn't exist with the internet, which means that allows counter narratives to develop more freely, and it's very hard to monitor and actually prevent certain discourses from being online. This is also a negative and a positive. It gives more representation. It allows a better democratic balance, but it also means that in terms of counter narratives, the extent is pretty important. That's one aspect in which it changes. I was talking about groups. It changed the dynamics of groups. Masses, meaning a mass amount of people, can form online. It's not just people in the streets now. We can very well, there are networks of people, and that's one of the things this project shows, is that the conversation is not limited to a country or even it's not local, it's a global conversation. So the network of people is massive, and that does have an impact on politics. And the third aspect I was talking about was it influences autonomy. If you're, I'm going to go outside of the range of violence, but if you're a child that has that is homosexual and you're growing up in a neighborhood where you don't feel like you can identify or talk with someone online, it's very easy to find someone online and to be able to it's an a space where you can easily help empower yourself through like-minded people who have similar tastes and share the same causes, which is of course in the case of extremism and radicalization, you can find very easily people who, at least in far right extremism, you can find a lot of people who are like-minded and share your opinion, meaning that if around you offline you can't, well, online you will be able to integrate large networks, and that can empower you in a sense.
Okay, so if I understand correctly, it's like that online, the social media are creating like additional space for people that can find like-minded person and then create this kind of like social information bubbles to
yes, it's accentuated by, you're talking about social bubbles, which is accentuated by the algorithm that actually puts you in contact. It's a pretty well-known fact now that when you go on Facebook or Twitter or I'm talking about the main platforms, but most of the platforms do this, LinkedIn, they're going to put you in contact with content you have previously liked. And so they know what you like and what you dislike. And it is their advantage to have you come back. So they're going to show you content that is similar to what you've previously liked, which creates kind of a filter bubble system, which means that impacts massively, typically right-wing. In the case of the studies of radicalization, it's extremely important because it's going to show you only people who like, let's say, right-wing extremist ideologies or Islamist extremist type content. And it actually gives you a sensation, but a false sense of everyone thinks this way, when in fact, absolutely not, of course. It's just the algorithm prevents from showing you counter narratives and what you actually wouldn't want to see, because that's not possibly the way you think, or that's at least the way the algorithm is built and those platforms are built.
Mm-hmm. And from your research, because this is also something that I found interesting, could you see that groups or people that are spreading this kind of opinions that we are discussing today, like radical extremist ones, are they aware about these algorithms that you mentioned of social media?
I honestly have no idea how much people are aware of what is going on in kind of the backstages of platforms. I there's probably research out there saying it, commenting on, so I wouldn't want to say, I do not know to what extent people are aware of counter narratives or narratives that aren't theirs. The thing is that it does favor a very, these kind of bubbles, they do favor us and them. They do favor a radicalization of opinions in the sense of they build themselves, of course, around the idea of an us. So they create collective entity, a collective identity online. And to be able to create an identity, you have to say what you're not. To be able to say who you are, you need to be able to say who you're not. So that does favor that.
Because we already started talking about that, and I wanted to ask you maybe to walk us through a bit like the main points, the main results of your research concerning that, how radical groups are using or are present at social media.
We summarized it into three main points. The first question was, what is the state of online radicalization? Is there still a level of online radicalization for Islamist extremist groups? Because we heard in the media that they had really slammed down on Twitter, that they'd really... one thing I didn't actually say very clearly is that our study only pertained to Twitter for technical reasons, and in the end, we had to stay on Twitter. And also that the countries we studied, there's 7 countries. We didn't study, of course, all of the European countries, which were Norway, Belgium, Netherlands, France, Germany, Greece, and the UK. So a pretty decent picture, but still, of course, not all the countries. And so the first question was, what is the state of the online radicalization? Can we actually even talk about online radicalization, or is this just a general idea? So that was one level of results. The second level of results was had to do with, how are people using Twitter? What are the main repertoires of action? Is this political activism? Are they using it to that extent? Are they actually using it to indoctrinate other people? That was the second question. And the third level of results had to do with, are there online resources for radicalization? because we can't just go about our business and assume there wasn't. So regarding the first level of results, it has to do with state of online radicalization. What we found immediately before actually even having to do any kind of analysis was we had a very hard time finding Islamist extremist accounts. They were not the ones that used to be. There were actual recruiters from ISIS online in 2015. This was not the case in 2018 when we started our fieldwork. What we found were quiet Salafists, preachers that are known to be supposedly apolitical, which of course is debatable, but they were not promoting violence, and actually quite on the contrary. So the first element we found for the state of radicalization on Islamist extremist end of the spectrum was what was considered as extremism online was more the product of labeling. It had more to do with how the state had labeled content on Twitter, how the company was labeling content on Twitter. And there was no form of expression there was a lack of form of expression regarding the actual thoughts of the people we found. The people we found were openly saying we are against any form of violence, we're against any form of extremism, yet they were quiet to Salafists, so they could in certain respects fall within within our sample. It was complete opposite when it came to right-wing extremism. We had a bunch of accounts that were loud and proud. They grew in ranks over time. And so when we go back to the question, what is the state of online radicalization? Well, in the case of the far right wing, it's very strong and it's growing. Whereas in the case of Islamist extremism, I'm not saying it doesn't exist online. I'm simply saying it's not, it doesn't exist on Twitter. The second element of a response for what were our main findings has to do with how do people use Twitter? It was interesting because for the Islamist extremists, we did find quiet Salafists that we can consider as extremists that are often positioned as such. But what we found was kind of, they were marketing branches of faith, meaning it was local branches of faith, kind of local schools of faith around the quiet Salafist movement that they developed. So it was a storefront in a sense. It was a storefront for blogs. It was a storefront for webinars. It was a storefront for products that they sold online. So they used it in a very social media marketing way, which was kind of surprising to have this capitalist and the religious encounter between the two. And so they'd offer lifestyle tips and tricks and know-hows, so how to be a good quiet Salafist and adapt this way of living. But there wasn't much content in terms of, it didn't go any further than that. As for the political act on the far right, however, it was really political activism. There's a debate in social science that online political activism is just clickivism or slackivism, meaning people just click and they're not doing much more. We did see that this online behavior translated into devious offline behavior, meaning we had actual people of conversation saying, oh, I'm going to this and go strike in the streets. So we know that this translated into offline activity. So we were actually dealing with political activism. And the last finding we found had to do with the online resources for engaging further into extremism. We set aside the Islamist extremist sample at that point because really we had no elements to say that it was helping people radicalize. We weren't on the right website for that. For the far right, what we did see is that there were three elements. The narratives, meaning the themes, the conversations, the debates that were going online. The second one was the influencers, meaning who is starting the conversation and what are the conversations that are being pushed by these people. And the third one was the conversations themselves were part of a milieu. They really created what we can call a milieu of global conversations. What was important regarding the themes is that the themes had to do, I'm not going to go in deep necessarily at this point, but had to do with feeling an unfair double standard or an unfair treatment, really a victim, sense of a victimhood. The second aspect was the influencers, unsurprisingly, but at the same time, it still needs to be shown. And at the time when we started this research, it wasn't completely clear. Influencers are legitimate politicians in particular, Donald Trump, who steered the conversation quite a bit. And that was kind of dramatic. He set the tone for a lot of the discussions. And this leads us to our third finding in respect to what helps, what is actually considered like resources to become a more radical person through consumption and participation in these online spaces, was the conversation, which was a global conversation. It went way beyond national discussions. We could have thought with, like, in France, we had the yellow vest jacket movement at the time. We could have thought that it would have been limited to France. And we saw that discussion, for example, went extended to Belgium, the Netherlands, and so on. So the conversation is at a level where the far right wing movement nowadays it is not just a national one, it's a European one at the very least.
There were quite a few very interesting issues that you mentioned. So thank you for that. Probably we could talk much longer about each of them, but maybe if we can stop for a while and discuss a bit more about this transnational aspect of the discussions on Twitter that you, as you analyzed it. So maybe if you can explain how it works, and also you could, and also if you can, if you could also observe maybe some differences, because you said quite a lot about differences between these both groups of this both group of radicals that you have observed. So are there also some differences between them when it comes to this transnationality?
How does it work? It's attached to people and hashtags. It's attached to people first and foremost. If you're following Donald Trump, he sets the tone for that conversation. It works through, one of the things that was absolutely startling to us was that the conversations grouped around a very little amount of themes, meaning that there were influencers either online personalities that were well known within the communities and that everyone follows, and so those people set the tone of the conversation. So either online personalities or well known leaders, like I was saying earlier. So that's one way the conversation spread, and that's one way the conversation is united. And so it's going to be linked to hashtags so that people intentionally enter these conversations and exit these conversations and make sure they spread. And of course, there's a game with the algorithm again that's going to show you what's the most discussed topics. And it's going to show you in particular topics you're interested in, you're used to. So the platform has a role in those conversations and connecting people. The transnationality, how does it work? What we noticed also was that the conversations were on a day-to-day. They followed the news event, the mainstream news news circuit. So every day, that's how the conversations flow too. They're very tightly linked to what's going on outside of Twitter. And so in that respect, conversation flows from influencers who have a huge impact on who's leading the conversations, and that is directly linked to what's going on in mainstream media, meaning TV, press, old school almost media. So that's one of the ways that the conversations flow, and that's how transnationality is created. Another aspect is above and beyond that, actually, above and beyond the narratives themselves and the discussion, the conversations, there is, at least on Twitter, the possibility at this stage to self-represent oneself through the use of a banner, the use of icons, the use of like your picture. You have a little space where you can present yourself. So that is spaces in which each person can represent themselves. And we're talking, this is not LinkedIn with your actual name, your actual profession, etc. So people have a tendency in these types of groups to represent them themselves in a way where they're sure to be identified as part of a larger entity. So that, of course, creates, that highly cements the transnational, or at least the national aspect of it, identity aspect of things. As for the difference between the countries in respect to extremism. Greece, for example, was not able to find any Islamist extremist accounts. Norway was in difficulty. So, of course, we have different levels of engagement in both strands of extremism. The far-right wing extremism in the UK and France is not the same one as in Greece or in Norway. Norway, we had a discussion at one point about to what extent is the content more censored by the state. So that can also affect what we're studying and what we're looking at. Does it mean that outside of offline, it's not a strong presence? That's another question.
Okay, and when it comes to some differences, or are there any differences when it comes to this transnationality also between right-wing and Islamist radical groups?
So the one part that there were no differences with the Islamist extremist group is that the fact that anywhere in Europe we can't, it's the fact that it's Twitter. We're on the wrong platform. As for the right-wing extremism, I'm still really in the process of some of the dissemination phase and comparing the data between the countries. And right off the bat, honestly, I wouldn't be able to answer that in a more complete manner than I've already done, actually.
Okay, so maybe I will try to rephrase my part of my previous question. Yeah, so because I was also wondering, I mean, I'm also a researcher, so I'm aware that the sources of data are limited when it comes to the scope of their usage. But however, anyway, I was wondering if through your research you could observe that those extremist groups, because due to the fact that those ideas are kind of like in a flow around Europe from the country to the country, mm-hmm. Can we say that we talk more about some international networks of organization, or it's only a flow of information, of opinions concerning
it? Yeah. So what we did, okay, so to go further to your question of how this transnationality functions, there was one element that was really important is that we did see linguistic impacts. The Francophone, I mean, everyone who spoke French, meaning Belgium, part of the Netherlands, Netherlands anyways, ended up in there. France had a kind of a parallel conversation. There are countries that were much more spread out and far away from the conversation with Greece, for example, because I can imagine typically our hypothesis, we didn't go any further with this, but was that the Greek maybe speak less English. The country that was really in the center of the conversation was the UK. And our hypothesis, of course, was that it was due to the fact that it was the English speaking language. So the linguistic aspect of elements probably played a role. That was at least our sentiment. Germany, for example, which was, I would say, physically has more borders with a lot of countries, wasn't center to the conversation. Again, we would say the linguistic barrier. So the flow of conversation had to do with indeed probably linguistic elements. Those who were influencing the conversation, even if they were followed. And then there were groups in Pakistan, like the Yellow Vest movement was a good example. It was only a French language speaking phenomenon. So it covered three countries, which is not a small phenomenon.
Okay, so we may rather say that social media and like Twitter, they rather foster the communication between the groups and individuals living in particular countries.
It facilitates the conversation in a lot of manners. It necessarily facilitates the conversation because you would not be able to speak. This is if we went 50 years back, this is a public space as a public forum, as a public arena, as it was 50 years back. But there is no way these people would have been put in contact. So the circulation of ideas is when people say the world is smaller in a context like this. If we go back to the 1930s, because a lot of people compare the night when you're studying right-wing extremism, there's a lot of comparison with the 30s. The level of development of the conversation is from the bottom up is astounding. So and it's supported, and so you would have to go. I wonder to what extent there would be. I'd be interested in a comparison between the United States and Europe, because there's a lot of things going on in public space, meaning inside shops or in the streets, whereas in Europe not as much, but online. It's very open. The valves are open. there is very little limits to what is being said.
If we maybe now can try to turn to some ideas how to counteract these issues, if you maybe can give us any clues coming from the results of your research, if somebody would like to counteract radicalization also online, where he or she should go, what to do, where, on which aspects or which kind of activities should focus at, and so on and so forth. And ideas would be useful.
Hard, it's hard, but it's an important question that must be tackled head on. Within the project, we didn't all agree on how to manage the question of should we monitor, should we censor, should we include and let people freedom of speech, even though freedom of speech does have a limit, which is the law. So in the end, our conclusion was to say that it's important to kind of find a balance between inclusiveness. Because these are people, at least on the far right, when we use terms, I'm not going to deal with Islamist extremism because they're dealt with in a sense. I mean, they just aren't there. As for the far right, it's one of the things that was argued within the project was to say these people are people who feel that they're already unfairly treated. They go very quickly to victimhood. So when you censor their account, that might exacerbate that even more and radicalize them more. So there was a discussion about balancing inclusiveness and removing extremists. So how to find that balance, and it is a difficult task. What is important, I think, is to improve the diagnosis of online extremism, better tools or better conceptions of what is extremism online and how to identify it. Another element to counteract what is going on online could be greater transparency towards the user of how it's being done. I don't think people realize that there are tens of thousands of people removing content online every day in the Philippines, for example, or even in the middle of the United States in Idaho. I think that aspect of things, it was better explained. And another element is much work needs to be done on disinformation. The level of disinformation that circulates online is, I believe, unforeseen. The last few years it has gone, it has been increasing. So those are areas in which counteracting can be done. Then there's measures and initiatives that can be taken, but that's very areas in which, or ways in which to attack all the question of how.
Maybe do you know any like particular initiatives that you can point out as useful ones? Or
there are efforts that are being made. Like I said, there's of course just the fact that I don't think people always realize this, but internet is a very particular space in the sense that you publish first and then there's censorship. Not too long ago, we had to, anything that was published in a public manner, on say a newspaper, was first monitored and then published. So there's already a massive amount of monitoring that goes online. This monitoring could be improved. It's done mainly, there are regulations from states, but this monitoring is mainly done by big tech themselves. So there's a lot of work that needs to be done in terms of a better, more efficiency between big states, the states, meaning the governments themselves, to move forward on what is being monitored, how to monitor it, and how to just apply the law, because the law isn't necessarily always being applied online. So there's improvements that need to be done, and I believe that has to go through private agencies or some kind of agencies. There are agencies at this stage that do de-radicalization programs. They offer alternative content. They offer spaces for offline discussions. They kind of reach out in different manners. So that does exist. It's just not at the level of what it needs to be, given the level of disinformation and extremism that is harbored in mainstream websites and platforms such as YouTube, Twitter, and Facebook. So, and as for other elements, there's work probably to be done on the algorithm itself to break down and cease this bubble effect that creates division within the population and harbors it and fosters it. Yeah, and there needs to be some kind of accountability for what is being said online, which at this point is, and that can be done very easily by the fact that users are anonymous on a platform like Twitter. They aren't on LinkedIn. So if someone is taking some kind of public stance, well, they might as well do it with their own name. That is another simple way to change the rules of the playing field.
You actually mentioned something that I also wanted to ask you about directly, is the solution that already is being undertaken to change the algorithms. So as I understand, in your opinion, trying to change the algorithms of social media can be one of the solutions.
That is a major stake. It's a major stake. And at this point, that and the lack of actual identity on platforms, even though Facebook is a counterexample because... But Twitter is, there's a lot of fake identities, so it doesn't help.
Okay, and also I have to ask you about this a bit more drastic solution that was adopted also against one of the main characters that you mentioned, one of the main influencers that you mentioned, Donald Trump. So do you think that for example, I don't know, banning
that came too late.
Okay.
You had to wait for a coup in the States for it to happen. That is just dramatic. The fact they let that go on for so long is dramatic. And all this in the name of freedom of speech. The real difficulty here is, I would say freedom of speech, but at least that was the sentiment in the public debate. The real difficulty nowadays to monitor far right extremism is that I'm thinking of a French word, aiguille, where we put the actual needle of what is extremist has moved, and the leaders that are actually elected have, of course, enforced that since we have gone much more right in the last past years. So when you have a world leader such as Donald Trump or Bolsonaro that are actually online, meaning Trump, of course, in this case, but online, or Salvini or just a number of personalities who are actually public figures, they change the rules as to what we can monitor and cannot monitor. If you're just commenting on what the president said, how can that be outside of the board, outside of the space of which is acceptable? So that is the difficulty, but it's a hard question that needs to be answered, because things aren't getting any better on their own. So it needs to be dealt with. And in the case of Donald Trump, it was way too late in the game. Should have happened way earlier, but it happened. At least that's an improvement.
And maybe a supplementary question to that would be from my side, because I mean from your research, when I was also reading the results, I had the impression, because I mean anyway, you describe the situation that whereas when it comes to the right wing extremists, you could find quite a lot of the content like more openly presented on the Twitter, then when it comes to Islamist radicals, it was not so. It's not so much. So my idea was that maybe it's because of the fact that they moved somewhere else. So the question is, if we cancel or like ban many other people, also like right-wing radicals, they can also move somewhere else, as we know that it's already happening.
Absolutely,
yeah?
absolutely. Yes, but yes, and I think there was, so at one point it was Telegram, and then they went over the summer to, I can't remember, there's a I know Steve Bannon was implied in the whole creation of this alternative platform that at one point disappeared and came back. Can you remember the name of that platform? I can't remember.
No, I can't. But
there is alternative platforms. But the thing is that it's been proven over time and through studies that if you disseminate a group, you can radicalize some of the core, but you're gonna shed off a larger part of the group. So in the case of Islamic extremism, we were not able to actually we did no research on the state of extremism. However, we are very aware of the fact that there are, of course, still Islamist extremists out there. it's simply not in a place where if someone is looking for something, this is something I answer often when people ask me, can you go online and find radical ideologies or become self-radicalized, which is an expression that exists. Yes, of course, if you're looking for something online and you look hard enough, you will find it. It's just that it's not ideas floating around in the main spaces, because by floating around in main spaces, it gives it legitimacy that it wouldn't have if it's in darker corners, underground corners of the web.
Okay, fair enough. I understand. So maybe if we can just close with the question going back to the future, going a bit to the future, I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, what are your ideas or your expectations? I mean, when it comes to all those threats related to using social media to disseminate radical and extremist views, I mean, are they going to grow, or maybe we will be able as a society to counteract them somehow? I mean, what you see right now?
I would like to think we are going to be able to counteract them. I think that kind of question is outside the realm of the social sciences and goes to, I have no idea what's going to happen. It has more to do with the personality of the researcher you're asking, as if it's an optimist or not. I must say I'm not an optimist. So I believe history works in cycles. And so we have a tendency as humans to forget pretty easily. And unfortunately, I am not optimistic, but that is really more my personal sentiment. And it's really impossible. I mean, who would have thought of COVID 2 years ago, who has kind of changed the games on so many levels? So I honestly, I'm not optimistic, but that's more a personal view than a researcher perspective. I will say this, and this is not, that has nothing to do with our research and the DARE research. I'm a French American citizen, and I was in the United States last week. And the fact that people were talking to me about civil war, which is completely mind boggling for me, because I hadn't been back for 4 years, and in 4 years ago, no one was talking about civil war. So things go very fast, very fast. I also, and this is as a private citizen, I would say this. I think people are not aware of how bad the situation already is, that there's a lot of indicators and red flags that are not promising a bright future. And that in Europe, I feel like COVID has maybe, we have Brexit, of course, but has kind of tuned down the conversation on extremism. But it can also exacerbate, actually, in a very short term, the level of engagement in extremist ideologies. And we were not on the right path before COVID. So let's hope for the best.
Okay. And let's say that, as I understand, also with rising awareness, we can bring this mm-hmm. end of the, or change of the cycle closer.
For sure, we're far worse than we were for a few years ago in terms of level of extremism in society. That's an absolute, that's if we look back on the last few 4 or 5 years, there's no way of saying any other thing. It has risen, and ranks are growing, that's for sure. That is something that we can scientifically show, that ranks are growing online.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so it makes also our discussions and your work more important. So I wish you good luck with that. Yeah, and thank you very much for sharing with us and being with us.
Again, thank you for having me.